Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
A new list released by British Daily, The Sunday Times, says there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than half a trillion pounds. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, The Sunday Times' rich list. In this country, it says, 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair. Particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentments at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men. At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizep, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily, will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his five-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
On Friday, about 2,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital calling on the Mario Draghi government and the EU to stop sending weapons to Kyiv and finally promote peace talks to resolve the war in Ukraine. The initiative had been called by a number of base unions and supported by a string of leftist movements. People at the rally expressed high concern over the serious military escalation by all parties involved in the Ukraine conflict.
The EU is not acting right. Its wary posture has only put one bloc against another. The people are those who will suffer from our rulers' decisions in the end.
There are too many conflicting interests at stake, and Italy is far to survive. The EU should do more. I don't support Putin, but I'm also against Zelensky. He is not acting in the interests of the Ukrainians.
Following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Italy has opted to gradually cut its gas reliance on Russia. Rome has been importing gas from Moscow for over 50 years, and about 45% of its total demand is provided by Russia.
I'm a small retailer. I was forced to close down during the COVID, but I haven't seen a cent of support from the government. And now they spend billions for the war. When will they look after us?
Undoubtedly, the Italian government is far too aligned with NATO, but it's not just that. The government is very much distant from the people, as surveys show the majority of the Italians are against the war.
Since the start of the conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. About one-fifth of the surveyed Italians have so far said they are in support of the Draghi government's delivery of heavy weapons to Kyiv. The conflict in Ukraine, its dire consequences and the fear it could spread or go on for a long time are not the only worries Italians are concerned with. Rising inflation, a growing cost of energy, blocked salaries, continual crumbling of purchasing power, all economic indicators are pointing towards a recession. Many expect the country to be faced with a hot autumn of strikes and protests. Max Civili, Rome.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ, located just behind me, is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, speaking to Press TV, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine Action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has visited Oman. Not only does this trip build upon the brotherly ties that exist between the two countries, they discuss regional issues. Iran's President has said that regional countries should solve their problems and that foreign powers should not interfere and leave the region altogether. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the relationship between these two countries and look at the role that Iran plays when it comes to other countries in the region, including problem areas like Palestine and the presence of foreign forces. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Expert in West Asian Affairs Kevin Barrett joins us from Madison. Also joining us is journalist and political analyst Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who joins us from Islamabad.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Kevin Barrett, and ask you about the visit by Iran's president to Oman. It was pretty wide in terms of the MOUs that were signed, 12 agreements, cooperation agreements from what we understand. So in terms of trade, it was obviously very fruitful. And prior to that, they revived a gas pipeline that was in the works for quite some time. How do you see this relationship in terms of its significance, especially for the region altogether?
Well, this is a very good move for Iran, Oman, and the whole region. The 12 cooperation agreements cover all kinds of ground. And as you suggested, one of the most important, probably the most important, is that gas pipeline issue. That's been in the works for well over a decade. And, of course, the Western powers, well, that's a euphemism, really, for the United States, which is largely under Israeli control when it comes to U.S. Mideast policy, has been blocking it and trying to find ways to make sure it doesn't happen. And now it may be that the Americans are of two minds. On the one hand, of course, they're still brutally sanctioning Iran. They're being completely unreasonable in their JCPOA negotiations. And they're obviously still under the thumb of the Zionists. But on the other hand, they have a huge problem on their hands in Ukraine, where, contrary to what the Western media tells us, Russia is achieving its objectives in this special military operation. And at this point, with energy prices soaring and Europe trying to find a way to live without Russian gas and oil, but gas being the biggest problem, and the U.S. Desperately trying to make sure the Europeans stay on this course of boycotting Russia and substituting liquid gas, the propane variety, for the gas they've been importing from Russia through pipelines from Russia. There's a huge market right now for this liquid gas that can be shipped overseas. And apparently Oman wants to manufacture that. And Iran has one of the largest, possibly about the largest, or tied for number one in terms of all gas reserves. So it may be a propitious time for this. And it may be a time for Iran mm-hmm. to break out of its isolation, or it's not really isolated, of course. Iran is trading with most of the world, including the biggest countries like China, as well as Russia and many others. But it's been hammered by the West and the United States at the direction of the Zionists. But this may be a time to change that. And by breaking out and becoming a savvy player in regional diplomacy, building on this relationship with Oman, we could see a sea change in the region as other regional powers understand that the future of the region is in independence and autonomy and freedom from Zionism and imperialism.
Well, let's take a look at some of the stances taken. And one of the most important ones that came out of this meeting, say, Mohsen Abbas, is what Raisi noted about dialogue and cooperation, where he said the remarkable key point is that dialogue and cooperation among the regional countries would create security, but the presence of foreign forces would not by any means, and could even threaten regional security. First of all, what do you think about that, and isn't that a direct reference to the U.S.?
It is absolutely a direct reference to the U.S. I think Iran has long held that the West Asia region, or the region surrounding Iran, must become much more autonomous, independent, and not reliant on the United States as the local policeman, which is exactly what the Arab world has largely facilitated. I mean, they've cooperated and collaborated in their own, if you like, their own subordination. And let's not forget that Donald Trump, for all his ills, he said it very, very plainly. He said, we're here to milk the cow. And he was referring to Saudi Arabia. But of course, that extends to Kuwait, extends to the United Arab Emirates, and all the Gulf region, really. And that's exactly what the Americans have been doing and continue to do. And of course, Israel gets its benefits from that American boots on the ground, will support you militarily and strategically. What Iran is saying is that, look, we're here to stay. America's going to eventually leave. They don't belong in this region. They belong in the Americas. But when the oil runs out, when your gas runs out, when they no longer want to milk you as cows, what are they going to do then? Who are you going to turn to? So the reality is that the Arab nations need to think very, very deeply about their longer-term interests. And I think Iran has continually offered them a very reasonable alternative, and that is, first of all, I think, in President Rouhani's era, where he launched the Hope Initiative in the 74th session in the UN General Assembly. That Hormuz peace endeavor floundered with a counter, if you like, measure by the Americans and the Israelis to open up relations with the UAE and to sort of open up more relations with Bahrain, et cetera, the Moroccans too. But of course, this visit of Amir Abdullahian to Oman and meeting Sultan Haitham bin Tariq is a positive indicator from the Iranian policy perspective, in the sense that upgrading those cultural and political reactions or those relations, rather, to higher levels of economic and business cooperation, kind of set a pattern and a trend. And it's not an isolated trend, because Iran's Customs Administration spokesman, Ruhollah Latifi, said very recently that Iran's trade exchanges with its neighbors from March to December 2021 were valued at 92 million tons in volume and more than $46.2 billion in cash. And that constituted basically an increase of 13% in volume and 28% in monetary value from the year prior. Now, that also added to that is that Oman has had a 40% increase in its bilateral trade with Iran during the past year as well. So you can see that Iran is making inroads into creating not only that sense that there should be an independent West Asia, which really relies on its own economic power for itself, rather than being milked like a cow, as it has been done for maybe six or seven decades or more.
Sure. It's interesting, Kevin Barrett, our guest there, mentioned the Hope Initiative that was actually presented by the Iranian former Iranian President Rouhani at the UNGA. And made me think about one of the failed initiatives that the U.S. At one point had proposed years ago, and that was what we call West Asia, this region, the West Asian Arab NATO. Remember that? How it flopped? It didn't even take off. However, this initiative that Sayyid Mohsen Abbas talks about is something that actually Oman has taken the lead now on, that insisting on continuing the cooperation with Iran to provide maritime security and to counter maritime terrorism in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and the Strait of Hormuz. So in that light, Oman has taken the lead, and that is very significant, isn't it?
Indeed, yes. This kind of security cooperation with Iran will ultimately be in the interests of other countries in the region as well. These countries currently are experiencing the difficulties of being essentially, if not exactly colonized, but certainly client states of a declining empire. And as the U.S. empire continues to decline, this whole notion of an Arab NATO and global NATO and so on will seem more and more absurd, because obviously what NATO really is it's a euphemism for the U.S. military occupation of Europe, which began after World War II and never ended. And the rest of the world doesn't particularly want to be occupied by a single unipolar hegemonic empire. There are better ways to ensure global and regional security that can also preserve the autonomy and independence and sovereignty of the nations involved. And of course, that is what Russia says it's ultimately fighting NATO about. And it's also what China, the rising number two power, espouses. And given the economic changes in the world, as the West's share of global GDP declines precipitously, clearly the future is in these kind of independent regional security arrangements between sovereign nations in a multipolar world, rather than everybody signing up for some super NATO and being occupied by the U.S. military in a unipolar world. That's a pipe dream. It's never going to happen.
Looking at the respective countries, which we will take a look at that, say, Mohsen Abbas, one thing that just stands out preventing security and stability to be established in the region, no matter practically wherever you look at, is Israel. Whether you look at Syria, whether you look at, for example, Iraq in terms of Erbil, and, of course, with the way that the occupation is being exercised, with the rights of Palestinians being violated on a daily basis. Putting that next to the normalization of some of these Arab countries, isn't that one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest, to make sure this region is free from outside interference? And, of course, Israel is being steered by the U.S. in some respects.
If Israel wasn't in West Asia, there would be peace throughout the region. I have absolutely no doubt about that. The fact that the Americans are there is primarily because they have this kind of bizarre commitment to an illegitimate state, which is essentially committed to expansionism through its Yinon plan, through its peripheral, so-called expansion policy as well. These are all givens that the American Congress seems absolutely incapable and, deterred in terms of trying to change policy-wise. The fact is that big Zionist capitalist corporate mafias control the bulk of American politics, and unfortunately, that is what dictates the situation in the Middle East as it is today. Now, Israel will not stop its expansionism. It's currently more paranoid than it's ever been before, predominantly because the Islamic Republic of Iran has stood tall and has managed to assemble a resistance axis, which is saying no to the oppression of all the oppressed in that region, and particularly the Palestinians. So until Israel can first of all really negotiates its own self-annihilation, essentially, there will be no peace in that region, because what they're doing is buying up these other proxy states like Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, and then they are pushing forward illogical, irrational foreign policies, largely which are aimed at securing the interests of Israel, not the interests of Saudi Arabia or the interests of the Bahrainis, etc. So, for instance, the war of the Saudis in Yemen does no justice to them. There's no need for them to have that war. They're so wealthy, they hardly need Yemen to become any wealthier. The war, for instance, in Syria, which the Saudis and the Gulf nations engaged in, was another war that they financed on the say-so of CENTCOM and the Israeli sort of military establishment and the big boys who want to dictate the affairs in the region. So everything is wrong about Israel being in the Middle East, just simply from the point of view of peace, prosperity, and if you like, stability. The Islamic Republic of Iran, by contrast, has not invaded any of these countries,
right?
Not for 200 years as the Iranians stepped outside of their own territories. They've been largely rather invaded. So the same Israeli and American forces imposed an 8-year war on Iran, killed over a million, soldiers or citizens one way or another of that region. Since then, they haven't stopped. Iraq, Syria, up even as far as Libya, if you want to count Afghanistan, these are all bordering, mainly sure. They are bordering countries to Iran. And so, of course, that mass chaos and that warfare is what Iran is trying to avert for the future with its policies in the region now.
So, but you have to put this into context for us in terms of how this works out when you have, for example, the UAE, Kevin Barrett, courting Syria, just one of the countries, which indicates obviously there's a shift underway when it comes to Syria, along with Jordan, who has done the same, and Bahrain. In the meantime, these are countries that have a relationship or have formalized their relationship, which, by the way, did exist before, but they just came out and formalized it to the world, with Israel. So how does that work out? I mean, when you have them reinstating Syria into the fold, so to speak, but yet at the same time have this relationship with Israel.
Well, they're trying to play both sides, and that's understandable because we're in a period of shift. The geopolitics of the region and of the world is moving fairly rapidly, perhaps increasingly so, towards this end of the unipolar American imperial era. And in the West Asian region, I agree completely with the other guest that there would be peace and prosperity absent this illegitimate Zionist entity, which is the root cause of the worst conflicts. And you know, we see how its lawlessness with the assassination of Colonel Hassan Syed Khodei the other day on Sunday, and then a couple of weeks ago, the murder of the American journalist Shireen Abu Akhla, these are just two recent examples of this kind of ridiculously lawless, psychopathic behavior from the Zionist entity. So why would these countries like the Emirates and some others that are moving towards a more rational and balanced regional policy and openly recognizing Syria, perhaps against the orders of their usual masters in Washington, why would they be moving towards friendship with the Zionist entity? Again, I think that they are kind of trying to bet on both sides or situate themselves in such a way that they can draw some sort of profit to themselves and political advantages from their seemingly friendly relations with the Zionists. But we have to remember that the change in the region is towards more independence from the imperial powers and the Zionists who run and own them. And so I think that these people who are betting on profiting from a short period of friendship with the Zionists are also seeing that in the long term, the Zionist entity is likely to go the way of the dinosaurs, and that's why they are simultaneously open to these kinds of regional peace initiatives like we're seeing with Iran and Oman.
And it's very interesting in terms of Syria. We have some more hot spots that we need to talk about, but can't leave this one alone yet, say Mohsen Abbas. And that is the fact that you have what happened days ago for the first time with the Russian S-300 missile defense system actually fired shots for the first time, enacted by Russia, towards those fighter jets that had bombed Syria. And there were speculations at this point that that is because of the fact that Israel has supported Ukraine in the special military operation that Russia has done. Can you explain to us how Russia fits now into the picture when it comes to Israel? Because Syria remains a country that Israel just continues to bomb, which it did again just a couple of days ago.
Well, this has been a bit of a thorny issue. But the Russians, quite clearly, whilst they came to Syria and supported the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hezbollah, and the Syrian government in, if you like, averting the collapse of Syria, essentially, and the occupation of Syria by Zio-American forces, they at the same time have been playing a balancing game. They have had amicable relations with Israel. The Russians have many citizens that actually go and live in Israel itself. There are clear indications that the Israeli establishment goes to and fro and has largely garnered the neutrality, at least, of Russia in affairs. And in fact, there was also talk of Russia agreeing that they wouldn't use these S-300s. In fact, they wouldn't do anything to prevent Israeli warplanes dominating Syrian airspace. There seemed to be an informal agreement between all the powers as to who dominated which part of the aerial sectors. Now, one Russian plane was actually shot down accidentally, it seems, or the Israelis played a certain game in which they shadowed in such a way that the Russians weren't able to save one of their aircraft, and actually several Russians died. That didn't trigger any kind of major response from the Russians. They certainly obviously raised concerns, But what's happening now in Ukraine, it seems as though, again, where Ukraine has a large support from Israel, it also has a lot of Ukrainians who are in Israel as well. It seems as though Israel has been torn between keeping that neutrality with Russia and going in and supporting the American and NATO aggressions, essentially, in Ukraine. That's been a choice that it hasn't been able to avoid. And it seems as though some of the exchanges between Foreign Minister Lavrov and the Israelis have got very, very deep. And perhaps this could see the signal, well, it could signal the Russians taking a more hard line on Israel in West Asia as well, and particularly in Syria. That remains to be seen.
Sure. And what remains to be seen, but it seems to be on a positive track, and this could change the not only the equation on the ground, but also the it's almost like a tectonic shift that's going to happen. And that is the way that Iran and Saudi Arabia have had some degree of rapprochement with each other. They are talking to each other. There has been some progress, but it's not there yet. At the same time, Saudi Arabia it doesn't even have a channel of communication open with the U.S. President, Joe Biden. It doesn't even talk to Joe Biden, the Saudi Crown Prince, including the UAE. So if that remains that way and Iran and Saudi Arabia continue and open up embassies, for example, does that mean then that that could be the final straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of the U.S. not having really the solid footing in the region any longer?
Yes, I think it would be. I think that the Saudis have played the key role in maintaining U.S. dominance of the region, and they are the swing oil producer globally. And so their importance, despite the fact that their rulers have not always been particularly competent or exemplary, they have played an outsized role in the world. And now that suddenly we see them moving out of the American orbit, as indeed the Saudi king had threatened to do in the summer of 2001, just a month before 9/11, he said that the writing is on the wall. He said it's time for, quote, the parting of the ways. And in fact, it was only the false flag operation of 9/11 that allowed the Americans and their Zionist masters to reel Saudi Arabia back into the American orbit. We could see something like that again. And if so, it will be good for the region and for the world.
Now, I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Kevin Barrett, expert in West Asian affairs from Madison. Saim Hussein Abbas, a pleasure, from Islamabad, journalist and political analyst. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading "Drop in Life Expectancy Speaks Volumes About How U.S. Handled COVID," expert says. Here's the details. Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021, which followed a well-documented drop in 2020 and contrasted a recovery trend in other high-income countries. The paper, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, shows that U.S. life expectancy fell from 78.86 years in 2019 to 76.99 years in 2020 and 76.60 years in 2021, a net loss of 2.26 years. The study comes as progressives in Congress continue to fight for Medicare for All legislation to replace the U.S. for-profit healthcare system, one in which 112 million adults struggle to afford care, according to Gallup and Wealth Health. The research also comes just days after a Poor People's Campaign analysis exposed how the public health crisis was twice as deadly in poor countries as in healthy ones and exacerbated pre-existing social and economic disparities that have long festered in the United States. Johns Hopkins University's case tracker reported that recently, COVID-19 had claimed 984,571 lives across the United States of America, or nearly 16% of the more than 6 million deaths globally. Dr. Stephen Wolf, co-author of the new study and director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, said in a statement that we already knew that the U.S. experienced historic losses in life expectancy in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. What wasn't clear is what happened in 2021. Early in 2021, knowing an excellent vaccine was being distributed, I was hopeful that the U.S. could recover some of its historic losses, said Wolf, adding, but I began to worry more when I saw what happened as the year unfolded. He said, even so, as a scientist, until I saw the data, it remained an open question how U.S. life expectancy for that year would be affected. It was shocking to see that U.S. life expectancy, rather than having rebounded, had dropped even further. In addition to examining the United States, the researchers looked at life expectancy over the past 2 years in 19 peer countries and found a smaller drop between 2019 and 2020, an average of 57/10 years, followed by an average 28/10 year increase from 2020 to 2021. While other high-income countries saw their life expectancy increase in 2021, recovering about half of their losses, U.S. life expectancy continued to fall, Wolf said, adding, this speaks volumes about the life consequences of how the U.S. handled the pandemic. taking aim at policymakers who opposed efforts to curb the spread of the virus. The expert added that in a country where U.S. Constitution and 10th Amendment grant public health authority to the states, I believe the U.S. catastrophe speaks volumes about the policies and behaviors of U.S. governors, at least some of them. A highly effective vaccine was available in 2021 that made COVID-19 deaths almost completely preventable. Wolf highlighted that while the Delta and Omicron variants significantly contributed to the death toll in the United States, those mutations also impacted other countries that saw life expectancy rates rebound last year. He said deaths from these variants occurred almost entirely among unvaccinated people. What happened in the U.S. is less about the variants than the levels of resistance to vaccination and the public's rejection of practices such as masking and mandates to reduce viral transmission. Noting high rates of heart disease and obesity as well as inequities in access to healthcare in the United States, lead author and University of Colorado Boulder sociology professor Ryan Master said that those same factors made the U.S. more vulnerable than other countries to the mortality consequences of COVID-19. The study states that over a two-year period between 2019 and 2021, U.S. Hispanic and non-Hispanic black populations experienced the largest losses in life expectancy, reflecting the legacy of systematic racism and inadequacies in the U.S. handling of the pandemic. Wolf said that sadly, it was not a surprise to see the disproportionate impact on people of color. Our research had shown previously, but there was an interesting plot twist in 2021. The only decrease in life expectancy occurred in white people. Life expectancy in the black population even increased. Despite that increase, he pointed out, life expectancy in the black population remains far lower than in other groups, but the disproportionate impact on white people holds clues to what happened in 2021. Co-author Ladan Aron, a senior fellow at Urban Institute, told the Washington Post, "It's hard to imagine that willingness to be vaccinated is not a piece of that puzzle. The life expectancy gap between the United States and its peer income countries is now over 5 years, which is an incredible gap," she said. "Death and life expectancy? That's the ultimate marker of what it means to live in a country." The new research comes after a March study published in the journal Population and Development Review, which found that global life expectancy appears to have declined by 92 tenths years between 2019 and 2020, and by another 72 tenths years between 2020 and 2021. Changes in life expectancy between 2019 and 2020 in America, Europe, and a few other countries have received copious attention.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.